This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We've spent months trying to understand a political crisis that is gripping the UK. You might say our next guest has spent most of his musical career trying to do the same.
I don't want to change the world. I'm not looking for New England. I'm just looking for another girl. I don't want to change the world. I'm not looking for New England. I'm just looking for another girl.
That's Billy Bragg from his 1983 single, A New England. His more recent work has included recordings of old railroad songs, recordings inside railroad stations, and a multi-album epic completing the work of Woody Guthrie at the behest of Guthrie's daughter, Nora. Bragg is an activist, a balladeer, and an author. His new book is called The Three Dimensions of Freedom, and he and his guitar join us here in studio. Billy Bragg, welcome to 1A.
Thank you, Joshua. Great to be here.
We welcome your questions for Billy, especially if you are a fan of his music. So comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, email 1A@wamu.org. If there's any music by Billy Bragg that particularly touched you or moved you or was important in terms of the canon of his work, we'd love to know about it, what his music means to you, 1A@wamu.org. I'm interested, first of all, in some of your political thought, and then we'll make our way towards music. And we will hear you perform in a little bit. But as it relates to Brexit, it seems to have everyone in the UK tearing their hair out. But as I understand it, there is at least one thing that you and Prime Minister Boris Johnson agree on somewhat, and that's honouring the result of the Brexit referendum.
Yeah, the result of the Brexit referendum is important to honour it. But it depends very much where you believe parliamentary sovereignty lies. Does it lie with the result of the referendum? Does it lie within Parliament? Or does it lie ultimately with the people? If it lies with the people, and I believe it does, yes, they voted to leave in the referendum, but the subsequent general election gave us a Parliament that was looking for compromise. It gave nobody a majority. And we're left in this situation where now it's not been possible for Parliament to find a way forward. So the Parliament we're living with, the situation we're in, is as legitimate as the referendum result. And this is one of the problems of trying to mix a sort of a populist idea like a referendum with parliamentary democracy. The two of them don't easily come together.
I think at this point, and you've heard this as well as I have, but there are plenty of people who are suggesting a second referendum to vote again. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has requested another referendum, possibly another vote on Scottish independence. What do you think of all these do-overs?
The Liberal Democrats at the weekend, who are the third party, a smaller party, identified very strongly with the idea of remaining in the European Union. At their Congress at the weekend, they decided to just abolish Brexit without another referendum. Now, this is it's quite an extreme position because it dismisses the 17.2 million people who voted to leave. You know, I don't agree with them, but I recognise that they're legitimate in voting that. So you've got the two of the political parties, the Tories saying leave with no deal, which is a rather extreme position, the Liberal Democrats saying just abolish the whole thing. And the problem is nobody wants to talk about the nuances of Brexit. And if anything is going to save us from ultimately leaving the European Union, it's nuance. It's the nuance of the Good Friday Agreement that protects the peace in Northern Ireland. It's the nuance of the Irish border. It's the nuance of our economic ties with the European Union. But unfortunately, nobody seems to want to get to grips with the nuances.
That's so complicated, though. It's complicated. It makes for bad television.
Yeah,
like, come
exactly,
on.
Exactly. That's it. And the Labour Party, who hitherto have been, Jeremy Corbyn's been attacked for not being clear, his policy, which is to try and get a better deal and then put it to another referendum with Remain on the ballot. So you'll get an option for his deal or to Remain. He's suddenly now the centre position. He's now the moderate. I mean, how we've got to this position, because he was, you know, he's supposed to be an extremist, and moderate and centrist are almost pejorative terms in British politics. But that's where Corbyn has been left, just by sticking to his guns and saying the people, this has got to go back to the people. We've got to let the people decide.
Well, it can be a pejorative term in American politics, too, depending on who you ask.
Yeah.
But for you, as an author, as a musician, a songwriter, an activist, how does a political moment like Brexit affect your self-expression? Are there certain ways? I feel like it's easy as a socially conscious performer to feel almost dragged in the direction of, I have to comment on this. I have to write something. There's all this other stuff I want to do, but I have to do something on Brexit.
Because that's where the debate is. I mean, you know, if you're going to be a singer-songwriter who wants to intervene in the national debate, you've got to be riffing on what people are talking about. But the question is whether you get into the minutiae of it or whether you try and stand back and see a larger picture. And what I've done with the new book, The Three Dimensions of Freedom, is I'm trying to identify what's missing in both our politics and perhaps the politics in the United States of America. And I think the missing thing is accountability. You know, there's the what you refer to in America as the culture war is really an issue about who gets to make the rules and, importantly, who gets to break them. And this, we're having this same problem with our current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who's trying to break the rules around our unwritten constitution. So I think this issue of accountability, how do we hold those in power to account beyond democracy? Because I don't think democracy and accountability are always synonymous. I think at times when there's a consensus in the country, then they are closer together. But their relationship is more like a Venn diagram. And at the moment, accountability and democracy are quite far apart in my country and in your country, partly because of our voting system, where the person who gets the most votes doesn't win the election, but also because people have lost faith in the democratic process. And we need to find ways to go beyond merely just holding our politicians to account. We need to give the people a sense that they have some kind of agency again. That's what's missing.
With regards to the title of your book, The Three Dimensions of Freedom, what are those three dimensions?
Well, liberty, obviously, the most important bedrock of freedom. Unfortunately, there's a new generation of free speech warriors who believe that they have the right to say whatever they want to whoever they want, whenever they want, with no comeback whatsoever. That's not liberty. That's license that they're looking for, because liberty, freedom also has to involve equality. And by that, it doesn't just mean that everyone has equal rights. It means everyone has, you must give everyone equal respect. You must give respect to their point of view. You must listen to their point of view. That's really important. But that still leaves everybody being able to shout out 2 + 2 = 5. You need something else there. And that crucial thing is accountability. Because without accountability, then liberty can become the most dangerous of all freedoms, and that is impunity. And both your president and, I'm afraid, our prime minister at the moment are trying to act with impunity. And democracy doesn't seem to be able to prevent them from doing that.
So liberty, equality, and accountability.
They're the three dimensions, yeah.
With regards to our political state, Denise tweeted, I saw Billy Bragg play in Cleveland in February 2017, soon after the election, and something he said has stuck with me ever since. In discussing the uncertain state of U.S. political affairs at the time, he said, this is where we are, not who we are. That thought has talked me off the ledge many times. Elaborate on that. This is where we are, not who we are.
Well, democracy takes you to some strange places. When you've got a majority you feel particularly strongly about an issue, not everybody feels that way. And I think since the election of Donald Trump and since Brexit in my country, we've also found that the polarization within our politics has been quite shocking. So that it's the extreme views that are being expressed rather than that kind of a consensus that we had before. So ultimately, you see someone representing you. Brexit doesn't really represent us. You know, when I go buy a coffee in London and I'm being served by someone from a European nation whose status in our community is going to be threatened by Brexit, I want to say that to them. I want to say, listen, mate, you know, we're not all against you. You know, this is a deep seated problem that goes right to the core of who we think we are. Our post-imperial psychosis that we have in the United Kingdom is all about Brexit. And I think we have to try and separate ourselves from those people who claim to represent us, the Brexit majority in our country.
Let me talk about some of your musical influences. You've cited The Clash as a major influence, not just musically, but in terms of how their activism fired you up. Talk about how that happened.
Well, when I was 19 years old, I didn't have any way to communicate my ideas to the world. If I wanted people in the United States of America to hear what I had to say, I had to really learn to play guitar, write songs, and do gigs. And punk rock kind of came along, and that was incredibly self-empowering. You know, you didn't have to wait for someone to come and say, you can do this, son. You just went out there and did it. And that kind of invigorated me to start getting up there and speaking my mind. And consequently, the attitude of punk, not the haircut, not the trousers, not even the sound of it, but the actual attitude of it has continued to inspire me for the last 35 years.
Punk is one of those musical genres that almost requires you, A, not to wait, and B, not to allow yourself to wait. You kind of have to dive in.
Urgency to it, which is great. Because I think that's a bit, and I see that feeling reflected in the school climate strikers. You know, I think the spirit of punk rock is there because they are self-empowered. They're not waiting for someone to come along and lead them. They're taking action themselves. And I find that really inspirational.
Well, it's interesting because there are people who look at today's music and think, you know, it's kind of lost its socially conscious edge. They'll watch, you know, the MTV Video Music Awards and say, see, it's all just the same kind of pop music. But then on the flip side, you know, Taylor Swift, who won with her song and in her performance at the VMAs, it said Equality Act in augmented reality over the screen. You know, Lizzo.
That's very powerful. Lizzo, very powerful as well. But I think the point is that since the end of the 20th century, music has lost its vanguard role in youth culture. Although we didn't think of it in those ways in the 20th century, music was our social medium. It was the way we spoke to one another. It was the way we spoke to our parents' generation. Now, if you're 19 years old, you don't have to learn to play the guitar like I did. There's so many ways you can comment on the world. So music has lost that edge. But there are still communities. If you look at young black men in the UK, grime music, an artist like Stormzy, he has political content in his music because that's the only way he has to get into my timeline. If he wants me to hear his voice, he's got to make great music. He gets in there, gets up on stage, and then he attacks the Prime Minister live on TV, on stage. And the way the audience responds, the Prime Minister has to come back and address the issue. So music still has its edge, but it doesn't have that all-encompassing power where it's everything to young people. There are other mediums that they can put forward their ideas on. That's a positive thing. But no one's ever going to ask you to tour the United States of America reading out your tweets. So, you know, if you want to see the world, learn to play guitar, do gigs, write songs, it's not a bad way to do it.
We're speaking to musician and activist Billy Bragg. His new book is called The Three Dimensions of Freedom. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Let me play a track of yours that's based on lyrics from American songwriter Woody Guthrie. This is All You Fascists off 1998's album Mermaid Avenue. That's All You Fascists from Mermaid Avenue, a collaboration between you and Wilco. Woody Guthrie, Volume 1 came out in 98, Volume 2 came out in 2000. Tell us more about that project.
Nora Guthrie, Woody's daughter, was sitting on an archive of 3,000 complete lyrics that Woody had written in his later years when he lived in New York City. But like me, Woody Guthrie didn't read music, so there was no musical notation on the lyrics. She needed, in order for those songs to be heard, she needed someone to come along and write some new tunes to them. And she invited me to look in the archive. I hooked up with the guys from Wilco. And we had an amazing time wading through sort of mid-century American history. Woody Guthrie was active on so many different levels. There was so much stuff there. All You Fascists is a song of his from the Second World War. He was talking very, very specifically. But obviously, you know, it has resonance today. You know, one of the worst aspects of the election of Donald Trump, and in some ways Brexit as well, is that it seems to have legitimized bigotry. Again, some of the language I hear in the UK, some of the racist language I hear, I've not heard since the 1970s. I thought we were past this, you know, black players getting abused at football matches and stuff like that. So, you know, Woody's song, which was written almost 80 years ago, it has resonance again. So it's no surprise that songs that I wrote 30 years ago are still relevant in that sense.
Yeah, as I understand, Woody Guthrie's guitar had a sticker on it that said, "This machine kills fascists."
A very powerful message, yeah.
But then I'm glad you brought up, you know, British footballers or black footballers of color being heckled and harassed at matches, because FIFA has tried to deal with that, and stadia across the UK have tried to crack down on hooliganism. But you're not just talking about people in high places of power, you know, the Nigel Farages and so forth, who push for things like Brexit. You're talking to their supporters, to people who just buy a ticket and then go to O2 Arena and they yell and scream awful things at players.
Or they, you know, a player misses a penalty and they racially abuse him on Twitter or something like that. Yeah. It's been a big problem with that this season. The question is then becomes, where, how do you hold those people to account? That's the one of the real difficulties that we're facing at the moment. Obviously, with regard to you personally, when you're online, you're looking at the person you're dealing with. Do they respect equality, this person? Is he treating me equally? And are they accountable, this person? If I debate with them, will they respond to the questions I ask, or will they just ignore them? You know, using those three parameters of liberty, equality and accountability in our social media discourse allows you to work out whether it's worth talking to these people, whether you just get shot of them. But secondly, obviously, Twitter have a proprietary accountability that they can use, which is absolutely crucial. And I think, you know, if you're a landlord of a pub and someone comes in every night and starts a fight, you've got a right to throw them out. And that's true, whatever company. But there's one more level, which is how far does freedom of speech go? A man was jailed in Britain this year for painting on the door of a recently arrived black family, "No blacks here." I think any of your listeners would recognise that's not freedom of speech issue. That's bigotry, that's hate speech, and that has to be dealt with by the law. So there's a number of different, accountability works on a number of different levels. It's not a one-size-fits-all argument.
It's a very different thing now, I think, than in, say, the 80s, when you just put out an album, fire it out into the world, and let people think what they want. Now, you put out an album or an EP or a track, fire it out on Spotify, and within seconds, you are instantly in a political fray that you've created.
That's the great thing about it, though, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to add your perspective. You know, music can't change the world, and trust me, I've tried, Joshua, but ultimately it can offer people a different perspective, and that's what I'm trying to do, because that's what I get from the best people that I read online, is they're giving me a different perspective about the world. That's how the world changes.
Tim tweeted, "Circa 1990, I invited Billy to appear on my community radio show in Dallas. It happened to be pledge drive week, and when Billy found out, he immediately emptied his pockets of all the cash he had. Furthermore, he jumped on the mic and instantly began to help." Mike emailed regarding the song "Way Over Yonder in the Minor Key." "Thank you to Billy for dusting off this wonderful narrative of growing up and putting the words to music. Oh, and Natalie Merchant's harmony vocals, too." We'll pause now with that song as we continue our conversation with Billy Bragg. When we come back, he'll perform for us a song about climate change. We'll continue to take some of your questions and thoughts, and we'll talk more about this intersection between music and activism. Hey, if you're a musician who uses your music for activism, we'd love to know how. Email us, 1a@wamu.org. Stay close.
"Nobody that can sing like me, way over yonder in the minor key, way over yonder in the minor key, there ain't nobody that can sing like me."
We have shifted gears from our conversation about global affairs to a musician with plenty to say about the state of the world. We're speaking with musician, activist, and author Billy Bragg. Billy, before we hear one of your songs, I should ask, you've said in the past that you don't mind being labeled as a political songwriter. The thing that troubles me is being dismissed as a political songwriter. What do you mean by that?
Well, people think Billy Bragg is only about politics. If you come to one of my gigs, people are expecting it to be like a lecture. But, you know, it's really about entertaining people. I've found very early on in my career that if you just hammer them all the time with politics, it turns people off. I've performed with artists that do that. I'm trying to engage people. I'm trying to inspire people. And in order to do that, you need to sort of leaven up what you're doing with songs of love. You know, if you can't love your fellow human beings, if you can't feel deep feelings for those closest to you, what kind of socialist could you really be? Because socialism really is not worthy of the name if it isn't ultimately some form of organized compassion. And in order to have that ability to try and organize society compassionately, you've got to have that compassion yourself. You've got to have that ability yourself. So life is much, much more than politics. It's much richer than that. It's much darker than that. It's much more engaging than that. And I try to reflect that in my gigs.
You've got a song to perform for us called "King Tide and the Sunny Day Flood." Tell us a little bit about this song before we hear it.
I read about this situation in Florida where low-lying land, coastal land, is getting flooded every time there's a king tide, of a high seasonal tide. It's because the water in the Gulf of Mexico has not returned to its winter temperature for the last few years. So when it expands, when it gets really, really warm, areas of low-lying areas of Florida, water comes up through the ground. It's groundwater. It's water pushed by tidal water pushed up through the system. So they refer to this as a sunny day flood.
All right, let's hear it. Here is Billy Bragg here in our studio performing King Tide and the Sunny Day Flood.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could save the world and all simply by collecting up tin cans and empty bottles? We all want to believe it's true, but it don't matter what you do, so long as we continue to burn our way through fossils. Now it should come as no surprise to hear about the ocean's rise. Polar caps are melting with every year that the planet warms. Now people have to understand we're gonna feel it far inland. It's gonna shift the seasons and supercharge the storms. The king tide is a-coming. The king tide is a-coming. King tide is a-coming, bringing flooding on a sunny day. The king tide is a-coming, can't you hear the meltwaters running? The king tide is a-coming, gonna wash everything away. And you know, the oceans, they connect us all. No one can just build a wall. We have to work together, we can't do this on our own. Think that you can stand aside, nothing more than foolish pride, cause everyone's a libertarian till the brown water floods their home. Now you may live on higher ground, feeling like you're safe and sound, thinking as you look around, this is your lucky day. But everyone beneath the sky soon be looking for somewhere high and dry. Nothing you can ever do will keep them all at bay, because the king tide is a-coming. The king tide is a-coming. The king tide is a-coming, bringing flooding on a sunny day. The king tide is a-coming. Can't you hear the meltwaters running? The king tide is a-coming, gonna wash everything away. The king tide is a-coming, and we have to act today.
That's King Tide and the Sunny Day Flood by Billy Bragg. That's a beautiful song. It's part of a 6-song LP from 2017 called Bridges, Not Walls. I understand the making of that album was a little unorthodox?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of out on the road trying to get together, bringing songs together. Came back from a sound check, switched the TV on to see Donald Trump giving his inaugural speech. Sort of stepped in the shower. By the time I got out, I'd written 3 or 4 verses of a song that just come to me in the wake of that, based on a painting by Goya called The Sleep of Reason Breeds Monsters, and consequently got fired up by those kind of things.
What kind of impact do you want songs like the one you just played to have? I mean, it's a beautiful song. It paints a very clear picture. On the other hand, you know, I am a Florida native. I'm from the ocean side of Florida, not the Gulf of Mexico side of Florida. And I've had to just kind of accept the very real possibility that in 50 to 100 years, my home will be gone.
Yeah.
My entire hometown will not exist anymore.
Well, I live in a town on the banks of the River Thames, and the flood barrier that they built in the 1970s to protect London from surge tides is being used more and more frequently, and the tides are getting higher and higher. And if it comes to the state where that big tide comes, then my hometown equally will be flooded. I think you're trying to get people to connect with that idea. Music doesn't have agency. It can't actually change the world itself, but you can inspire a room full of people to feel that they must do something about this, not just for themselves, but they also realise that everybody else in the room is responding to this song, that they're not alone. Music has that power. But the key thing about music is it has the power of empathy. In fact, I think empathy really is the currency of music, whoever you are. This is not a political thing. It's as true as Ed Sheeran or Adele. A song can make you feel for someone you've never met, for an experience that you yourself has never had. It's always been like that, but these days we seem to live in a time when there's like a war on empathy, where anyone who expresses any sort of compassion for someone outside their own group is immediately dismissed as being politically correct. I mean, political correctness doesn't actually exist. It's a trope that's used by reactionaries in order to police the limits of social change.
Well, and yet we love Adele. I mean, Adele seems like she was born just to make people cry.
Exactly, and
but
that's the
we
thing.
We love Adele.
See, that's the thing about it. You hit right on the nose there, Josh, to make people cry, because you go to your Adele gig and you've got a song of hers that has some really deep meaning to you that you can't kind of articulate. Adele articulates for it, if you like. She's singing it. 5,000 other people are singing it. You're singing it at the top of your voice. Whatever emotion it is that you put into that song is accepted by everybody in the room. Not many places you can get that. You know, you get it at church, you can get it at football, at soccer, you know, where we sing at the soccer games. And I think that sense of communion, music has that power to bring that feeling up for people, and you can't get it online. That's the absolutely crucial thing. And I think that's why, although music now is cheap as chips, you know, you can get it for nothing if you want it, people are still flocking to gigs because they want that communal experience. They want that sense that they're part of something bigger than just themselves. And I think as a musician, in these times when there's a war on empathy, we need to ramp up that aspect of our music and make it explicit, if you like, about what we're trying to do here. That's certainly what I'll be doing at my shows here in the US. I'll be underscoring this and saying, you know, we need to fight our cynicism and find that empathic feeling that we have for one another and push on with that.
Another project you were involved with has to do with railroads. According to The New Yorker, a few years ago, Aperture magazine asked you to be part of a photo documentary commemorating the 90th birthday of Robert Frank. And they asked, was there any place in America you've always wanted to go and you'd never been? What'd you say?
Rock Island. Rock Island, Illinois, where the Rock Island line comes from. Because in the 1950s, there was a guy named Lonnie Donegan who recorded a song called Rock Iron Line, which was a song that had been widely popularized by Lead Belly, the great American, to call him a blues singer is unfair because he was a giant of American culture. And that song had a huge effect. It kind of inspired something called skiffle, which is rather obscure music in the US, but it's absolutely crucial. It was the music that John Lennon was playing with his band when Paul McCartney came to meet him in 1957. And what skiffle does for kids in my country is it helps to define them as the first generation of teenagers. It puts a guitar in the hand of every sentient young man in the UK in 1957. And then they go on to be the Rolling Stones, to be the Beatles, to be all those bands of the British invasion. So I knew this song and I knew how important it was, but I had absolutely no idea where Rock Island was. So we went there with this project, and it's kind of, you know, the history of the American Railroad is absolutely a fascinating story. And it ended up with myself and a friend, Joe Henry, we made an album of railroad songs on a train traveling between Chicago and Los Angeles, which was, and in between Brexit and the election of Donald Trump as well, which made it even more interesting, let me tell you. So yeah, it was a great trip.
Glad to get some of your comments, including some of you who use music as a form of activism. Katie emailed, I'm a singer-songwriter from Nashville. Finding my activist voice was an experience parallel to finding my artist voice. In the convergence of the two, we find, and I like this word, artivism, which was precisely where we can wrestle with the tension between liberty and justice for all. This is our great responsibility as American citizens to interpret and insist upon the Constitution to uphold our democracy. Music is a forgiving and empowering space for this. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Fritz emailed, as a union organizer and musician, I found Billy's songs to be inspirational and useful in my organizing efforts. There is power in a union resonates with all my interactions with union members. TJM asks, what do you see as the most important factors in defeating right-wing populism? With for-profit media doing what state-run propaganda machines usually do in totalitarian regimes, how do we reach people with the truth? funny he asks that, because you wrote a song about the biggest selling newspaper in the UK. Here is a quick clip from that song called Never Buy the Sun.
Someone's hiding in the bushes with a telephoto lens, while their editor assures them the means justifies the ends. 'Cause we only hunt celebrities, it's just a bit of fun. But scousers never buy the sun. While the parents of the missing girl cling desperately to hope, a copper takes improper payments in a thick brown envelope. And no one in the newsroom asks, where's this headline from? Scousers never buy the sun. Tabloids make their money betting bull baffles brains, and they cynically hold up their hands if anyone complains. And they say, look, all we're doing is giving people what they want. Well, they're crying out for justice, people crying out for justice. And the man they call the digger casts a proprietary eye over what happens in the gutter and what goes on in the sky. And he claims he's fit and proper, and the watchdog sings his song. The scousers never buy the sun.
Never Buy the Sun by Billy Bragg. I think your point seems rather clear there.
Yeah, I should just for your listeners say scousers are people from Liverpool.
You know I was going to ask.
Yeah, they're people from Liverpool. And
I needed you to translate from English to English.
It must be 10 years ago now, the Sun did some scurrilous reporting about a terrible event at a soccer match and blamed the people from Liverpool for they said some terrible things about them. And people in Liverpool simply don't buy the Sun newspaper. They don't stock it. And that's one way of dealing with that problem. But ultimately, how do we... Rupert Murdoch owns the Sun. How do we hold someone with that kind of power to account? I don't have that answer for you, Joshua. What I'm saying...
Well, you don't watch, you don't buy.
You don't watch and you don't buy, but they're still muddy in the water. They're still souring the debate in our country. So that's why I'm saying where the line has to be drawn. The line has to be drawn at accountability. We have to be able to hold the powerful to account. And that's the big challenge. You know, we've lived the last... 40 years with neoliberalism, with people saying that the market has all the answers. And as Margaret Thatcher said, there is no alternative to free market capitalism. Well, that's left people feeling they have absolutely no agency over their lives anymore, that the economic situation they find themselves in, they can't get out of. How do we make them feel as if they have agency again? Accountability does that.
You could support your local NPR station. Should I suggest that you support your local NPR station? Maybe
and
I should.
Join your local union as well, both those.
Before we let you go, Billy, what's next for you?
I'm on tour. I'm at the Birchmere in Virginia. I'm at the Bowery Ballroom in New York City, at the Sinclair in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and then I'm on tour in the UK, spreading the word.
You having fun?
I do. I love it. I mean, I'm in a very privileged position, Joshua. I get paid for doing the thing that I love doing. If that isn't the definition of success, I don't know what is.
Billy Bragg on tour here in the US through early October. His new book is called The Three Dimensions of Freedom. Billy, thank you for performing and thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
The 1A podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. We also put plenty of bonus material there. You'll find all the links to listen online at npr.org/1A. Today's conversations were produced by Morgan Givens and Paige Osborne. You can learn more about our team at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A. Yeah.